The voice of reason is TNT's John Matlin. The John Matlin Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen, friends, droogies, as they would say in A Clockwork Orange. People think that I come up with all of these intros in advance, and I can assure you I do not. It is May 7th. It is 11:05 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have Alex in the booth in Australia. We have Stacy, who got us guests from all around the world and throughout these past few months and coming out of California. I'm in New York. This is a global production right here, just bringing truth to the table. And that's exactly what we intend to do for the next 2 hours. So, without further ado, we have our first guest of the day, Dr. Harlan Ullman, a globally recognized thought leader and strategic thinker. Among the better-known innovative concepts are Shock and Awe, a brains-based approach to strategic thinking, and Massive Attempt of Disruption, a former naval person, a swift boat skipper in Vietnam who carried out over 150 combat missions and later commanded a destroyer in the Persian Gulf. He's advised heads of government and industry. He has also chaired several companies. Doctor, are you with us?
I sure am. Nice to be with you, John.
It's lovely to have you here, being that, you know, you are pretty much an expert in all things going on right now with Russia and the Ukraine. And this is a boiling, it's not even simmering, it's a boiling pot of water. And I would say the majority of the people aren't really paying attention to how truly, how truly scary this can get. Very quickly, it's as if people have kind of broken away, and they kind of think that they can virtue send their way out of the possible pending nuclear war or things of that nature. So, where do you see this going?
Well, let me first comment by noting that I'm delighted to be here. I have a new book out, as you know, called "The Fifth Horseman and the New Mad: How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation and the World at Large." And where we are focused right now on Ukraine and Russia, we have to realize that massive attacks of disruption indeed follow what's going on in Russia and Ukraine, because there's going to be a worldwide shortage of food. And we see these acts of disruption every day in our daily lives. How would you be able to get along without your cell phone, internet? What happens when power is interrupted, either by an act of nature or cyber hacking? And so while we are concentrating on Ukraine, and I'll get to that in a minute, the precursor, the harbinger of these massive attacks of disruption was COVID-19. Nearly a million Americans died of COVID-19 over the last 2 or 3 years. That's more than every American who was killed in battle since 1775. And we seem to just take that as a statistic. What are we doing for COVID-20, 21, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Now, the issue in Ukraine is extraordinarily serious, because you've got two parties that have irreconcilably opposed views. Putin cannot tolerate a loss, and Zelensky is not going to tolerate Russian presence. So how this ends is by no means certain. President Biden has already declared, as you know, President Putin a war criminal. How then do you negotiate with somebody who you have declared a war criminal? So an awful lot of our exit strategies are blocked. In Vietnam, where I served, we had this horrible metric called body count. We thought we could kill our way to victory, and obviously we did not and could not. I'm afraid that body count, however, applies now in Ukraine. The more Russians that are killed, the more Russian soldiers who die, the more likely Putin is going to have to make some kind of an accommodation, which would be to retain some portion of Ukraine, and there'll be kind of a ceasefire, as there exists and has existed since 1953 on the Korean Peninsula, for which there was no peace treaty. And that depends whether that's going to happen sooner or later. At this stage, our only plan or our only option is to keep as much stuff going to the Ukrainians to keep that in the fight as we possibly can, realizing it's their war and they cannot afford to lose it. Putin, of course, as you know, has threatened nuclear weapons. And my response to him, as I put in one of my columns, is to say, if you do that, our response will be overwhelming and it will be contained to Ukraine with a conventional attack that we are very capable of employing against you to destroy all your logistics and a good portion of your military forces in Ukraine, if you even think about using nuclear weapons. I don't think Putin will. I don't think he's going to get to the point of being desperate enough, but it's something that we have to consider. The other point that people really do not fully understand and comprehend is the power of nuclear weapons. My new MAD is a derivative of the old MAD of mutual assured destruction. Let me give you an idea of how powerful these weapons are. A nuclear weapon is measured in kilotons. That's thousands of tons of TNT equivalent. A thermonuclear weapon is measured in megatons. That's millions of tons of TNT. If a 10 megaton bomb were exploded over Washington, D.C., the fireball, and everybody knows what the fireball is, they've probably seen it on television at one stage or another, would encompass all of the District of Columbia and much of Northern Virginia and Maryland. These weapons are unbelievably explosive and powerful and destructive, and people don't understand that. I think that leaders probably do, and I think that was one reason why Putin would be very reluctant even to use a so-called low-yield weapon, because a low-yield weapon is going to be measured in the thousands of tons of TNT, and that's by no means a small weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's we watched how this has developed over the past month or two, and every time there was an escalation, it was every party involved, I feel, was making grave missteps, from Biden misspeaking or classifying things like Putin being a war criminal before having a conversation with the government itself. And we watched how Russia kept going in, even though they were getting pushed back harder than they can imagine. And we watched the support go from trying to stop Russia in a Cold War type effort to trying to make it hot, and people advocating for us to go in to a full-blown war with Russia, not realizing what that encompasses, even that starting with the no-fly zone they wanted to put in. And they didn't have a clue that would lead to us shooting down Russian aircraft. So, I mean, I think that a lot of people got caught up in the emotions of it, not realizing what the consequences were. And I mean, that's the same thing if you're on a schoolyard and there's a big bully there. Sometimes there's a way to get out of it without getting into a full-fledged fight, but sometimes you could emotionally punch the big bully in the face, and then now you're at a full fist fight. So, I mean, there's different ways to handle what we're watching go on, and it's as if the general public is kind of on the war hawk path at this point. And, I mean, my stance, of course, is we cannot get into an all-out war with Russia. It's not going to be good for anybody, for the world, and we have to stop going to war where possible, but we also need to find a way to negotiate, and it's not an easy situation to negotiate, as you had mentioned.
I think, John, actually in my book, The Fifth Horseman, I've got three chapters that cover both Putin and President Xi of China, and go into detailed analysis of Russia, the Soviet Union before it, and China. And one of the conclusions is that we tend to exaggerate the threats and dangers from Russia and China and underestimate the weaknesses. For example, nobody believed that the Russian army would be as incompetent as it was. Now, about your point about no-fly zones, I would take issue with some of that for the simple reason I think most Americans clearly saw that Russia was the aggressor, and it was destroying Ukraine. The videos that have come back are just very, very compelling. And so the natural reaction is, what can we do in a humanitarian sense? And the legitimate no-fly zones, in fact, it's what we did in Georgia in 2008 when George Bush was president and the Russians invaded South Ossetia, part of Georgia, was actually to do that. So this has history in the Republican Party. The point was that this was done on a humanitarian basis to try to do as much as we can to deal with the humanitarian issues. And of course, that became too difficult. And in fact, some of the things that you were saying represent Joe Biden's comments. I mean, Biden said he does not want to get involved in World War III. He said, we're not going to deploy American forces. In many ways, that was self-deterring. But my point is that for a number of reasons, and Putin did not go in this on a whim, Putin for the last 22 years has been complaining since he became acting president in 2000 about the West, and the West was doing things that were antithetical to Russia. Now, I'm not blaming the West, because this is all on Putin's shoulders for what he has done in Ukraine. But the point of fact is that one of the biggest problems we have in the United States is what I call in the book failed and failing government. Indeed, neither Republicans or Democrats have done very well in running this country. And you can see the mess we're in right now with inflation to the border. Look at what the stock market is doing. And this is a result of both parties being incapable of governing. Now, for the time being, there seems to be a consensus, certainly in Congress, to support Ukraine on both sides of the aisle. How long that consensus will last remains to be seen. And if it does not last very long, then you're going to have the worst of all issues, in which you have a very divided country. Probably the country has not been as divided since 1860, with a situation, as you rightly point out, is explosive and could get out of hand. We'll find out if Putin has anything to say on Monday, May 9th, which is Victory Day, the end of the Nazi regime and the Great Patriotic War, as far as the Russians would call it, whether he's going to do anything dramatic. My guess is not. I think he's what he's going to say is that the Russians are prevailing, they were going to win, and that they are going to come up with some kind of an arrangement which will be successful. We will see and we'll find out. But the point is, what is the exit strategy? And right now, the exit strategy seems to be to support the Ukrainians with enough military equipment and wherewithal to bloody the Russians sufficiently so that there can be some kind of a ceasefire, some kind of end to the violence. But I'm afraid that this is going to have very, very long-term consequences. As you know, Finland and Sweden are thinking about joining NATO. That raises huge, huge issues. For example, Finland has an 830-mile border with Russia. And Article 5, which says that an attack against one is considered to be an attack against all, the backbone of NATO. And I emphasize the considered. It's not an automatic declaration of war. But how to defend Finland becomes really an interesting issue that I hope people are thinking about. My point is that all these things that are going on are, in fact, massive attacks of disruption. What the Russian attack on Ukraine has done is really disrupt the order in Europe, the global order in many ways. It's going to have secondary and tertiary consequences. I said starvation and the absence of sufficient wheat is going to be very, very, very real. But it's these disruptive acts, whether of man or nature, that are affecting us and are the threat that we need to be prepared for. And quite frankly, the basis for our national security planning and thinking is based on conventional, traditional threats like Russia, like China, Iraq, North Korea, Iran or North Korea, and violent extremism. When this whole new array of situations of massive attacks of disruptions, which are not new, except they've come to the point where they are indeed able to disrupt our economy. I mean, supposing the electrical grid were taken down, supposing COVID-20 or 21 happened to arise, think of what COVID-19 did to disrupt the society. And so my argument is we have to broaden our experience, the aperture of our national security thinking. And the last three chapters of The Fifth Horseman and The New Man do that. How we make changes to try to bring a divided government more closely together, how to deal with changes in our national security policy, our national defense strategy, and indeed how the nation is organized to deal with these issues. They're explicit, and I think if they're recommended, if they're accepted, they can make a big difference.
Yeah, you know, this. You said something that truly strikes a chord with me, that both the left and the right have led us here, and that there is a severe issue with the way we run our government, and it has been for a very long time. So these little acts and the big acts of disruption have surely been showing their face. I mean, the other night, you know, there was Tucker Carlson had a very good report on about all of the food processing plants that have been burning down. And like you say, whether natural or man-made, it's a strange occurrence that you'd have so many different food distribution plants and stuff that would be destroyed on just by chance. So, you know, we're watching things develop, and we're already talking about having a food shortage and all of the disruption with fertilizer coming from Russia, and you know, we have a lot of issues on the horizon.
Let me make two points, John, that the fundamental problem is that massive attacks of disruption attack our Constitution. The Constitution is based on checks and balances. And right now, our government is not checked and it's not balanced. It only works if one of three propositions is in place. One party has veto-proof majority of both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue and five votes in the Supreme Court. That's never going to happen in our lifetime. Second, a crisis. Pearl Harbor rallied a really divided nation. COVID has separated us. And last, there's consensus and there's civility. None of those exist. And so it's our Constitution that is under grave threat by these issues that's going to require common sense and some kind of consensus. Second, and I think your audience will chuckle when they hear this, one of the huge problems on Capitol Hill is that before voting on a bill, no member of Congress has fully read it or understands it. In other words, how can you possibly vote on a bill that you don't read and don't understand? So one of my recommendations, which is a satirical one, is that before any member of Congress votes on a bill, they have to say that they have read and understood it. Now, people will say that's impossible. We'll take the Defense Authorization Bill, which is 3,000 pages in the Senate and 4,000 pages in the House. How can I possibly read it? But when Don Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense the first time in 1973, the Defense Authorization Bill was 93 pages long. We had 300,000 Americans fighting in Vietnam in the middle of a war. So this notion it's too big, I can't do it, is nonsense. And if you were a CEO of a public company, because of the law, Sarbanes-Oxley, if you did the same thing with releasing information about the health of your company, your balance sheet, so forth, you could go to jail. So why do we not hold members of Congress to the same degree of accountability that we do of CEOs? It's nonsense. And it's not going to change, unfortunately. But the fact is, Congress has got to do its job and Congress is not doing its job. And I must say, I think the last really competent president we had was George H.W. Bush. I can go in chapter and verse for presidents since then, and I do in my book, how they made classic blunders that have had irreversible damage. Whether they're Republicans or Democrats, it doesn't make any difference. They are equal opportunity, equal opportunity sources of disruption that have not necessarily done well by our country.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why I've decided, after my life got upended with my career in healthcare being taken away, that was one of the big reasons why I decided to run for Congress. Is there's so much, for lack of better words, stupidity that I've witnessed. And you know, it's one of the big things I really want to get rid of is the omnibus bill passing. It just has to stop. There has to be time. Yeah, it's where people stop squeezing in their partisan Easter eggs, I call them, and you find out later on, oh, this opens an avenue for something that no one wanted because the lobbyists wants it, and it's got to stop. It's destroying our country. And the time to fix that is now. But I do have to take a quick commercial break, and we will be right back on the flip side right after these messages.
On air and on the app.
I listen on the app.
Stay up to date around the clock.
I listen, therefore I know.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The United States government has declared you an enemy of the state. For the first time in history, a foreign journalist has been charged under the U.S. Espionage Act for publishing truthful information about war crimes. If convicted, our right to free press is over. We have been led to despise the journalist charged by a massive smear campaign directed at both the left and the right, yet his record speaks for itself.
He's the only journalist to have never gotten it wrong.
The charges are opposed by all major human rights and free press organizations, but our once trusted news outlets have failed to inform us. It is not too late. We can demand the UK stop the extradition of journalist and publisher Julian Assange. We can demand the Department of Justice drop the charges. Call UK Home Secretary Priti Patel at 020-7219-3528 or call the Department of Justice at 202-514-2000. They are not after him. They're after us.
Through the training.
Through the drills.
Through the driving rain.
Through borders, through bushes.
Through barbed wire.
Through doors, through windows, through walls.
Through water.
Through mud.
Through dirt. Through pubs, through clubs.
Through thick and thin. Through the noise. Through the shouting.
Through the silence.
Through it as a unit.
Through it as a team.
Through it all, together.
Your local infantry regiment is recruiting. To find out more, visit your local Army careers office or go to armyjobs.mod.uk. One Army, regular and territorial.
The radio station everyone is talking about, TNT. Where the longer you listen, the more reasons you find to keep listening.
Keep listening.
Today's news talk radio, TNT.
We are back with Dr. Harlan Ullman, who has recently put out his book. I'm trying to find it, and my notes just slipped out from my phone. Hold on. I got you, Doc. There we go. So it's The Five Horsemen and the New Mad, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to Divide a Nation and World at Large. So we're having a great conversation right now about the ongoing conflict with Russia and the Ukraine. And yeah, so we did briefly go off on the side about omnibus bills, but so we're looking at this, and you brought up Finland, and if they join NATO, having that border with Russia, this is the big thing that a lot of people never really address, Doc, is that they go through all of the territories, and you realize if Russia keeps moving in and expanding and taking back things that they lands that they had back in the USSR times, they're still going to be on the border with nations that are already there. So it's not like there's this buffer exists for any reason. If they push their boundaries forward, the buffer is gone anyhow. Then they're still on the border with NATO.
Yeah, but look, John, as I said earlier, and I lay this out in my book, The Fifth Horseman, we do not understand the weaknesses of Russia and China. People, I ask, what is the real threat from China? And they say, well, it's been, and there's not really a definitive answer. I think one of the biggest threats is that China could implode as the Soviet Union did. Look what's happening there. There's been a complete lockdown because of COVID. By the way, that dispels the myth that somehow the Chinese cooked up this virus, because if they did, they're the ones who are suffering more than anybody else. In Russia's case, the Russian army does not work, and the bulk of it is now concentrated in Ukraine. I mean, this is extraordinary. And so there is no chance that Putin is going to try and do something to the west of getting into the Baltics, because he lacks the wherewithal. And what we have to realize that one of the problems in Russia is a potential meltdown, and Russia could implode much as the Soviet Union did, because look, its economy is going to be in a shambles. It's going to be losing a great deal of its resources and money from the oil and gas that it's supposed to export. The population cannot be hypnotized forever that the war in Ukraine is going well. That will leak. And in today's age, even though the bulk of information that Russian populace gets is from television, which is controlled by the state, they have had possibly 20,000 soldiers killed. By comparison, in the equivalent amount of time on Iwo Jima, and everybody remembers Iwo Jima in World War II, John Wayne and the Marine Corps statue, and lifting the flag on Mount Suribachi, 6,000 Marines were killed in suicidal fighting on the resistance part of the Japanese in about the same period of time. In this case, the Russians have probably lost three or four, even five times as many soldiers. It's extraordinarily a bloodbath, and that's not going to continue. My point here is that the one thing that the United States needs to do is to develop a coherent plan on a bipartisan basis. And the fact is that, unfortunately, the White House and the Congress and both parties in Congress are not sitting down and saying, look, these are extraordinary times. When you take a look at the stock market, you take a look at inflation, we have got to work together. And whether Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell can reach an agreement, I don't know. But I would urge, and I do this in my book, urge that there's got to be a meeting of the minds of Republicans and Democrats, because most Americans are of the center. They're center left, they're center right. And I would say 10%, maybe 15% are extreme left and extreme right, who are dragging both parties to extremes. And so unless we can sit down and come up with some kind of a consensus view that can reject these extreme views, it's going to be extremely difficult to be able to deal with these problems, all of which are solvable if we have a government that's working. And I argue in my book, The Fifth Horseman, The biggest disruptor we have is failed and failing government. Government is just not providing what the American public needs. And by the way, this is true in too many parts of the world as well. But in our case, this needs to be fixed. And I would only hope that Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell can realize in what situation we now rest in terms of the dangers of disruption and realize that the common good has got to take place over party and power. And I hope one day that they come to that understanding, and the sooner the better.
Yeah. And, you know, so when this all kicked off, there was a lot of talk about the U.S. having biolabs over in the Ukraine, and that a lot of the biolabs were being targeted by. So there was, what was the deal with all of that?
That's nonsense. I mean, the United States has got research agreements. They're not biolabs, but it's easy to take anything out of context. And one of the big problems today, John, as you know, is that people are entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And a fact today is what I think it is, what it should be, or what I see on the internet, or what I see on social media. And so coming to some kind of conclusion, facts, is extremely difficult. But unless you have some kind of basis for making decisions, it's easy to exaggerate everything. And in today's world, conspiracy theories run amok. So if I say, yeah, I have absolute, you know, actually the United States has a secret bomb making plan in Ukraine, people will believe that, even though it's not true. And so how we can, one of the problems here is that government is simply not credible. And I can give you the date when that began, August 7th, 1964, with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. You may not remember, your listeners may not remember, but two American destroyers radioed back in the, they were in the Tonkin Gulf off the coast of Vietnam, that they were under attack by North Vietnamese patrol boats. An attack had taken place the day before. That attack never took place. But we voted with only two dissenting votes in the Congress to give the president the authority to go to war in Vietnam. At that stage, roughly 75% of the American public supported the government and believed the government. What percentage of Americans today believe the government, irrespective of whomever is in charge, Republicans or Democrats? And to take this a step further, the leakage of this draft memo from the Supreme Court on Roe v. Wade has now destroyed the legitimacy of the court. The last bastion of integrity has now been breached because somebody, for whatever reasons, has now leaked what's happened. And unfortunately, name an institution other than the U.S. military, whether it's part of government or out with government, that's viewed with any degree of confidence. The church, lawyers, members of Congress, the media, bankers, nobody. So we have a failure of credibility and a failure of legitimacy of government, which will take a long time to overcome. And the only way we fix it, in my mind, and I lay this out in the book, is through competence. And one of the things we need to do is to rebuild our infrastructure. And I argue for a national infrastructure investment fund of about $3 or $4 trillion, financed as we had war bonds during World War II, which would pay, say, 2% over prime, which would then be used to developing our infrastructure across the board. I don't just mean roads and bridges and airports. I mean supply chains. I mean research and development. I mean education. I mean the power grid. I mean all the things on which this nation rests. We can do it, but we have to put our minds to it. And the current $1.2 trillion that has been appropriated by Congress, first of all, is not enough. And second of all, I don't believe it has sufficient oversight to make a big dent. And so the book goes into this argument for a new national infrastructure investment fund, which ironically or interestingly is based on what happened in the United States after the 1918-1920 Spanish flu killed approximately 600,000 Americans, or about 1.8 million with today's size population. But after the Spanish flu, the United States entered into the greatest economic boom in its history, 1922-23, driven by electrification, by the automobile industry that was now beginning to mature, by new technologies such as radio, movies, so aviation. We have the opportunity right now with new technologies. And the way we pay for this is that government takes a slice of the action. If they're going to invest in company XYZ that's got this marvelous technology in the infrastructure area, why not take a slice of the action? We did that in 2008 when we had to make all the banks public to deal with the financial crisis. We took warrants. And so when the banks got well and the $800 billion that we advanced to the banks were repaid, the government walked away with $8 or $15 billion in profits. Why can't we do that today? We're an entrepreneurial country. It makes great sense. But nobody seems to have the vision or the will to look at these things more broadly and come up with common, and I'm talking about commonsensical solutions that families at home who have to decide where they're going to spend the next dollar, in many ways, would be far better in running the country than a lot of our politicians.
That's true. You know, if the government got money back on these deals, then we would work our way out of the debt that we find ourselves
and why
in.
Why not?
Exactly. It's not sustainable. The debt that we keep putting money out, and we don't stop. There's this idea that somebody somewhere should know how to balance a checkbook, whether you're dealing with trillions of dollars or billions of dollars. You have to realize when you keep purging money out and never taking it in that you can't sustain that forever. And that's where, endless inflation comes.
I'll give you a statistic. Right now, the federal budget is just shy of $6 trillion. Okay. We have a $30+ trillion debt. If interest rates go to 5%, that means the interest payment's going to be $1.5 trillion a year. That's 25% of the current budget. I mean, people have to understand this. And the way out, you're going to try and grow the economy, but that really hasn't worked. What you have to do is put in something like the National Investment Infrastructure Fund, which can bring money back over the long term. But more importantly, it can make this country competitive for the next century. And that's where I'm really worried. Our system of education, healthcare, supply chains, manufacturing, all these are basically still in the 20th century. And they've got to be modernized and brought into the 21st century across the board. Now, some companies are obviously doing that, but not sufficient. And unless we really can bulk up, there are two obvious conclusions. One, standards of living for virtually every American are going to decline in the future, your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And the American dream is going to be increasingly elusive. And I go into great detail in my book, The Fifth Horseman, how do we fix that? How do we repair that? And that's why I hope more people will read it and look at some of the recommendations and say, this makes great sense. Call their congressmen, call their leaders and say, why are we not doing some of these things?
Absolutely. I know. We have to become more creative. We watch what goes on with the supply chain, and I could tell you, being working at a hospital during the height of the pandemic, there was times where we were just like, well, we're out of IV contrast. Now, you can't do many CAT scans without IV contrast, but we're getting different parts of what creates IV contrast from different parts of the world. So if China had a backlog or there was any type of hiccup in this whole entire supply chain, you could not have IV contrast. Next thing you know, the hospital's making back deals with other facilities that have some extra contrast. But you run into the point where now if somebody has a stroke and there's no contrast to be had anywhere in the Northeast area, you can't do any of the angiography that comes with it. You can't do the studies that are needed. So this is a real issue, and we've given away a lot of our capability to produce this on our own terms by exporting jobs and trying to get a lower bottom line. So we don't make it here. We don't manufacture it here anymore. So there's a lot of issues.
Well, the point here is, John, look, whether we like it or not, the world globally is interdependent, and it's very vulnerable to these interruptions. And there's no way one country can be Antarctic, mainly it makes everything it needs and can't and is not relying on any kind of imports. That's never going to work. But what we have to realize is that, look, a ship goes aground in the Suez Canal, and for 2 weeks, the supply chain is so screwed up that they can't make cars in Detroit because there's a shortage of semiconductors. I mean, we have to understand that there's an interconnectivity here that is really part of massive attacks of disruption. And once that interconnectivity becomes disrupted, then we have these huge problems. But they're fixable by common sense and goodwill. These are not problems that cannot be overcome. I mean, go back to December 7th, 1941. The United States was attacked by Japan, as you know, and its battleship fleet was sunk. We had virtually no military, and yet we overcame all those issues to win World War II in conjunction with our allies. And unfortunately today, the issues are entirely different. We have to deal with disruption. It requires common sense. And as I said, my book, The Fifth Horseman, lays out a lot of these things which are commonsensical and we should be doing, which are apolitical. They're not solutions of the left or the right. They're solutions for America. And it frustrates me that we are incapable of dealing with many of these issues, which, as I said, are not issues that cannot be overcome. They are not being overcome because of a lack of imagination and a political system that prevents us from doing a number of things that we have to do.
Yeah, yeah. And we got to take a quick break. But again, right now we are speaking with Dr. Harlan Ullman, whose book is The Fifth Horseman. And we will be right back on the flip side to finish off our interview. We're having a great talk about everything that's going on. And I totally agree with you that we do need to find something that's not just party lines, but things that help the country. And that is what has been long lost. It's a long lost art. And people tend to just want to go with whatever the party is saying. But that's not always the case. There's some good ideas that fall right in the middle that the common man really wants, and that would help everybody. So, I mean, this is something that we have to start looking at and stop playing the partisan, I will not budge at all game. We have to do smart answers no matter what it is. So we will be right back after this.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Today, I have given formal notice to Russia in accordance with the treaty that the United States of America is withdrawing from this almost 30-year-old treaty. That was President George W. Bush's announcement in December 2001 that the United States would withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which commenced in 1972. TNT Radio reviews this news again, more than two decades later, as a poignant reminder as to why the situation in Ukraine is so dire today. The mainstream media has failed to explain why the US withdrawal from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty has led to increased tensions between the world's nuclear superpowers and the current crisis in Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has repeatedly condemned the United States for withdrawing from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty.
Today, I have given formal notice to Russia, in accordance with the treaty, that the United States of America is withdrawing from this almost 30-year-old treaty.
Russia's concern of U.S. nuclear weapons encroaching on its borders is legitimate. How would the United States react were the tables turned and Russia had a military alliance with Mexico?
Everybody's terrified of cancer, the big C. They don't want to talk about embarrassing things, so blood in their bowel motions, going more frequently, a persistent cough, losing weight. I remember a wee man who didn't come to my surgery for ages, and all he would do was apologise and say, "Oh, sorry, doctor, I know if I had come, I know you'd have got me sorted." We are not too busy. We are very, very keen to see our patients as soon as we possibly can. So please don't get scared. Get checked.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA. Or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
In 2018, 2.9 million people died of the flu and pneumonia. In 2020, there was a 98% decline in influenza, but 2.8 million die of COVID. Data never lies. We mandate that the truth be told.
TNT Radio.
We are back with Dr. Harlan Ullman, whose book, The Fifth Horseman, and the new MAD, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation and World at Large. We're having a great conversation. And yeah, so we have a lot to talk about. One of those ads that we're just on was very interesting. It was about the 2001 withdrawal from the Ballistic Missile Treaty. How do you feel that affected our relationship with that point with Russia?
John, we don't think about our history, and I'm glad you raised that because I go into great detail in the book, going back to the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration, as you know, wanted to expand NATO. And I was opposed to that because we didn't answer the question, what are you going to do about Russia? And Russia became, over time, neuralgic about the expansion of NATO around its borders. And we had just not considered that to be something of importance to us. In other words, the inadvertent, unintended consequences. George W. Bush did two things besides the war in Iraq, which was a catastrophe. He canceled the anti-ballistic missile treaty because he wanted to explore missile defense, fearing Iran, which is one of the exaggerations, but that also really angered the Russians. But worse than that, at the 2007 NATO summit in Bucharest, 2008 summit in NATO summit in Bucharest, Bush, because of other reasons, in almost an absent-minded way, said that NATO would extend membership to Georgia and Ukraine. Putin was there, and Putin said, this will not stand. And several months later, he put in place a false flag operation in Georgia, invaded it, and now South Ossetia is part of that, simply because of Bush's misstatement. Under the Obama administration, we had this pivot to Asia, making China the number one threat. We didn't bother to tell anybody in advance, and that overreaction, it seems to me, was huge. And then, of course, during the Trump administration, there were many, many similar mistakes. So the point is, this is rather like somebody who has smoked 10 packs of cigarettes and after 20 years comes down to lung cancer. We have had a series of bad policy decisions over the last 22 years or more. And these have led to the situation where we now sit. Now, if we had understood that, would the situation be any different today? I don't know. But one of the problems with presidents is that unintended consequences don't seem to make a difference. Lyndon Johnson, with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in August 1964, I referenced earlier, got us into Vietnam for a decade, a war that we lost. And similarly, presidents have got to understand the unintended consequences. And quite frankly, because of the nature of failed and failing government and the fact that perhaps the most precious resource in any White House is a minute, because time is just invaluable. There's not enough time to do everything. We don't do enough thinking about the weaknesses of our adversaries or about inadvertent consequences. And that's something that needs to be done. At this stage, it's a little bit late. It's like the married couple that have suffered marital abuse on both sides after 20 years, and one spouse decides to take action against the other. It's a little bit late. And all I can say is that we need to think our way more carefully through these issues that have tectonic consequences. And unfortunately, we don't in large measure because government is broken. And if one party says A, the other party says hell no about A, and there's very, very difficult means of reconciling those huge differences.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a question. So, you know, I heard about there was a speech that Putin had given where he claimed he had asked Bill Clinton in, I believe, 1999, if Russia would ever be able to join NATO. It sounds like the biggest propaganda push of all time. But have you ever heard of any type of conversation before that ever existed, or is that just hogwash? Yeah.
No, that's absolutely true. And in fact, the NATO-Russia Founding Act of 1997 was meant to bring Russia closer to NATO. But unfortunately, on the one hand, we wanted to do that. We were naive. You know, we thought that Russia and China could become more like us. We failed to understand the fact that other societies are different. Just as we didn't understand the Vietnamese society, just as we didn't understand the Afghan society or the Iraqi society, all wars that we lost. And this is what happened. When we were expanding NATO, we should have said, first and foremost, what do we do about Russia? And we simply ignored that. And yes, there were overtures. There's a great debate about whether we would station any troops as far east as we have. But the point is that that's unfortunately behind us, and we cannot change history. We can only deal with the future and do it in a much more coherent way. And at this stage, we're not doing it, in my judgment. And I must say that the book lays out policy directions. Right now, our fundamental policy, our national defense strategy, is based on containing, deterring, and if war comes, defeating Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. Well, it hasn't worked. How have we contained and deterred China and Russia? The answer is we haven't. And how can we win a war in which nuclear weapons are going to be used? As I pointed out, the destructive power is almost unimaginable. So I argue for a new framework, that, first of all, is out to protect us and our allies. It's to prevent these issues of disruption. It's to defend ourselves. And it's also to engage where we can, certainly with friends and allies and certainly with adversaries. And we're not really doing that. I don't think that we're protecting the American public as much as we should. We're certainly not preventing massive attacks of disruption. And our view of defending is to spend more money on defense. And quite frankly, what's interesting, and people don't realize, John, the more money we spend on defense, the smaller the Defense Department becomes in terms of personnel. 1992, 30 years ago, we had approximately 2 million people, 2.5 million people in uniform. Now it's about 1.3 million, and we're spending in real terms about 50% more than we did then. So we've got to change the whole basis for our defense because, quite frankly, it's not affordable. And so these are things that I lay out in great detail in the book. And by the way, with the new defense, and one of the things I call for is a porcupine defense, the image here, if you want to pet a porcupine, you're not going to like it. And as the Ukrainians have shown with a version of porcupine defense, they've been able to resist the Russian onslaught. And they've done it without a huge navy. They've done it without a lot of the type of forces that we have. And it's something that I think we need to think more seriously about, certainly in the defense of Taiwan.
Yeah. So another thing that commercial that we had on during the break brought up was basically like the Cuban Missile Crisis. When Russia was going to put missiles in Cuba, our response was, so our response was, oh, that's not going to work out. So, I try to look at this at all different levels here. If we were to expand NATO, would Russia have kind of the similar response that the U.S. had when missiles were put right on our borders?
Well, interestingly, it turns out, and I go into this in my book, the Cuban Missile Crisis was really initiated by John Kennedy and the Kennedy administration. In those days, when Eisenhower was president, he and Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev, was first secretary, the head of government in Russia, a detente, a peaceful coexistence. The Kennedy administration came in running on a missile gap, which in fact, there was a huge gap and we were hugely in charge and way ahead of the Russians in everything in terms of nuclear weapons and the Russians were inferior. But at that stage, Khrushchev had cut back on defense spending because he thought he had a deal with Eisenhower because he wanted to improve the Russian economy, which was on its back end. And so in comes Kennedy. And Kennedy has his missile, this whole new buildup. Don't forget the Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961, where we try to unseat Castro. And Khrushchev is stuck. So what does he do? He's hugely vulnerable because the Russians had virtually no nuclear retaliatory capacity. So how does he save his preference to put more money in the civilian side away from the military side? He says, look, I'm going to put missiles in Cuba. The Americans have got Jupiter mid-range missiles in Turkey. What's the problem? And so there turned out to be a huge problem. And the reason the Americans were able to prevail was because we had such great superiority over the Russians. That no longer exists today. In many ways, we have about equal number of strategic nuclear weapons, limited by New START of about 1,550 warheads, deployable warheads. The Russians have far more so-called shorter-range tactical weapons. But my point is that the situation in 1962, which in large measure was initiated by us without understanding the consequences, doesn't apply today. Russia's strategic capability is real, and it's something that we have to understand because, as I said, a thermonuclear war would literally destroy Europe, Russia, and the United States.
Yeah, and we've watched how weapons in general have become much smarter over decades, be able to strike with precision. And yep. I know when we dropped the Moab, not even a week, they tested the father of all bombs in Russia. And, these weapons are highly destructive and very, very advanced compared to missiles of old. And yeah, so we are looking at different ways and strategies that exist now that didn't exist then. So everything is very, very different in the whole entire landscape of combat. Another thing I wanted to bring up as we're getting toward the end of this interview is the corruption that exists in the Ukraine, in the Ukrainian government, and the way that money has possibly been funneled through. I mean, we only have the tip of the iceberg, I feel, with the Hunter Biden laptop, and you know, everybody's looking into that right now, and where that leads is yet to be known. But the thought here is that there's a lot of things that are going on in that country that are not pure, let's say, a lot of money laundering and such. And does this play into any of the ways that they'll be able to continue to maybe extort payments from the U.S. government if the current president is involved with different types of money laundering that has gone through there?
Yeah, first of all, you're right. Ukraine has been extremely corrupt. But I think that notion of corruption has been overwhelmed by Russia's illegal, unprovoked, and savage invasion. So that is not being looked at. And don't forget, during the Trump administration, Trump cut off support of Ukraine in terms of weapons. So there's a measure of responsibility. I don't think that the Biden laptop, look, would you like to have a son like Hunter Biden? And this is not necessarily a fault of the father, but when you had Bo Biden, who was clearly an extraordinary guy, and unfortunately, young Biden, Hunter Biden's character and so forth are greatly flawed. I don't want to go into chapter detail. I think most of your listeners know that. And it's unfortunate that a president has to deal with that. I don't believe that Joe Biden is corrupt. I think that's out. I know Joe Biden not that well. I just don't believe that. But one political party will use whatever it's going to need, truthfully or not, to try to discredit the other. And people are going to believe it. And so I hope that this is a secondary issue, because much, much larger issues are engaged here. But the point is that any one of these small issues, Hillary's emails, for example, can become explosive. And the nature of our politics today, which are septic, and indeed corrosive in the extreme. So yes, anything, even a small political nick in Washington can turn to become septic and it can become fatal. I don't think that Ukrainian corruption and the Hunter laptop are necessarily going to go anywhere, but there's a potential, because that's the nature of politics today, which is corrosive.
Yes, there's definitely a potential for anything to, like you said, a nick can become a massive massive wound that is purging blood at a record pace with the way politics are these days. So I guess we still have yet to see where that will go and if it will go anywhere. But it does raise questions, and eventually, to some degree, we'll have some sort of answers. But again, that variable has to take place, time. And hopefully in time we can have cooler heads prevail and find a way out of this. Is there a way, and it's, I guess this is the last question before we tell everybody where to follow you. So real quick, is there a way that this ends where we make a deal that the Ukraine will not be a part of NATO?
There's no way Ukraine is going to join NATO, period. It's just not going to happen, unfortunately.
That's off the table.
It has been. Unfortunately, NATO still has an open membership codicil that people want to join. And so they've not been able to deal with that contradiction. If we had said to Putin, you know, this is not going to happen, we'll give you some kind of degree. But unfortunately, we didn't play that very well, nor did we play well. Putin issued three demands. He wanted to have a new security framework in Europe. He wanted to have NATO retract from the East, and he wanted Ukraine not to be part of NATO. Instead, we said we'll deal with arms control. This is the thing I think determined Putin to say, okay, all right, if you're not going to listen to me, here's what I'm going to do. I can't prove it,
gotcha,
but I think that our responses were not necessarily the best ones we could have had. But we are where we are, and we've got to work our way through. And in a country where government is not doing what it is, this is a really serious, difficult issue. And the fifth horseman, I think, has some ways that we can turn things around.
Yes, tell you have about 45 seconds. Tell everyone where they can follow you and where to get the book.
The Fifth Horseman and the New Man, How Massive Attacks of Disruption Became the Looming Existential Danger to a Divided Nation, the World at Large. Go to Amazon, click many times, and the book will be there in a couple of days.
There you go. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a very interesting conversation. Absolutely. And we will be back at the top of the hour with our next guest, Tony Lyons, and we will have some more enthralling conversation for your Saturday. This is TNT Radio. I am John Matlin, and I will see you on the flip side of the news and the ads right after this.